Those of you who are interested in such things, it's actually unusual that Parshat Vayeshev is Chanukah. Generally, Chanukah comes out on either Miketz or Vayigash or both. So it's one of these oddities. I'm not saying it's impossible, but nonetheless, that is a thing that it's somewhat rare to have Vayeshev. Vayeshev begins a story. It's a new story. It's a story of Yosef and the brothers, and that does continue through Miketz and through Vayigash, and to a certain extent through Vayichi as well. So therefore, the beginning of the story is here, so there is something which is usual, and I'll just add another element to it, that on Chanukah, one part of the story, and maybe this is one of the reasons that there's not so much information in Chazal about it, but one part of the story is that it was a war between brothers. It was a war, it started off as a civil war. It was a war which between what was called the Jews and the Mityavnim, those who had adopted Greek values. And therefore, again, I'm saying things which are obvious and everyone knows and everyone has either, if not articulated it, then at least they've thought it, that in, you're not supposed to speak Lashon Hara in the Sukkah. I mean, by the way, the truth is you're not supposed to speak Lashon Hara any place. But you would think that the Sukkah, the Chafetz Chaim actually makes a point about it. The Sukkah, how could he speak Lashon Hara? There's actually a Yerushalmi that says that there were certain Jews who were thieves, and they would do terrible things, and they would lie and cheat and steal, but they wouldn't do it on Shabbos. On Shabbos, they tell the truth. They would speak the truth on Shabbos. And it mentions that there's a certain awe that we have for the holy, an awe for the holy. But on Sukkot, I remember there were people still sitting around and talking about the protests in Tel Aviv, and it was the us and the them. And then somehow the day after Sukkot, there was no longer an us and them that completely disappeared. So, you know, one element of this holiday of Chanukah is that it begins as something which we were a people who were divided. Eventually, the Greeks got involved in the war as well. So whenever secular people in Tel Aviv would celebrate Chanukah, I would find a great irony involved in this. And by the way, there was an active attempt, or perhaps successful, in order to hijack Chanukah and to take God out of the story. And a lot of the Zionist, secular Zionist songs and ways of depicting Chanukah, because again, think about it. If you want to try to find role models for a Jewish army, you'd have to go a little, you know, you got to go pretty far back to find a successful Jewish army. We haven't done that all that recently, you know. I mean, we're not as bad as France. I mean, France, their maneuvers, they practice holding white flags. But we just didn't have we didn't have an army for an exceedingly long time. So you have to go back to the time of the Maccabees in order to see. Again, you go Bar Kokhba, but that didn't work out all that well. Go back to the Maccabees to find a time that we were successful at fighting. But again, sometimes we forget, you know, who was fighting whom and what the background to some of that was. And it really was quite tragic. So let's now go back and talk about Yosef and the brothers, because apparently, you know, during Chanukah, which begins with some kind of a civil war, there is a civil war which somehow explodes. And, you know, that's the famous Rashi that Yaakov Bikesh Leshev B'Shalva. Yaakov thought he would be able to live in tranquility, and Kofetz of a love Rogzosha Yosef, and then the whole anger, the story of Yosef jumped him out of nowhere, or certainly, shall we say, Yaakov didn't see it coming. And had Yaakov seen it coming, presumably he would have done some things differently. And Chazal actually blame Yaakov for some of this, which, you know, it's not easy for us to blame matriarchs for things that they do. The Ramban does it a number of times. Chazal do not do it as much as the Ramban does it, but here's one of the places that Chazal do blame Yaakov for favoritism, for getting a coat. So if any of you want to get for your kids or grandchildren, want to get them coats of many colors, then get for all of them. Okay, let's avoid these problems. Just, you know, suggestions for your Chanukah gifts. You know, there's it's I don't know how many shopping days are left. And the funniest thing in Israel, when they have Black Friday and nobody knows what it is. So then someone decided that Black Friday sounds wrong, so they wanted Blue Friday, or Blue and White Friday, Blue Friday, which we have here, and also no one knows what it is. But it's apparently an opportunity to do retail therapy, which is incredibly, incredibly important. So let's go and let's start, and there's going to be certain things that I'm going to try to stress along the way. So we begin. V'Yisrael ahav et Yosef. So I've used that on occasion to pick on students and say, did Yaakov have a favorite? And they say, yes, Yaakov had a favorite. Who was his favorite? And then they would say that Yosef was a favorite. I would say, it says no place that Yosef was Yaakov's favorite. And they'll say, of course it has to say it, but it doesn't. Why is that somewhat unfair of me? Because it doesn't say Yaakov, it says Yisrael. And one of the things that we always suspect is that Yisrael is this more national identity, which means that he senses or he knows that Yosef has this incredible capability. I mean, the other part is the continuation. V'Yisrael have et Yosef mikol banav ki ben zekunim hulo. And normally the way to explain ben zekunim is that he is the child of his old age. And the problem with that is that he has a child of old age who's much younger, who is Binyamin. So how can this be the Ben Zekunim when he has a Ben Zekunim? So, and there are a couple of brothers who are not all that different from Yosef in age, which is why it's complex, which is why it seems or it feels that it's not really talking about Yaakov loving Yosef as much as Yisrael seeing the capabilities of Yosef. Note the Targum, and we're going to keep on visiting the Targum today, you know, where things are literal and where not. Over here, I mean, this is, he would say it was a literal interpretation. So he says Ben Zekunim, not as the son of somebody who's old. The Hebrew for Zaken is generally a word which we would read as Saba. Grandfather is Saba. Saba is the Aramaic for Zaken, for old man. I just wished the mazel tov to somebody who just became a grandfather, and I told him that this means he's old. And my wife was laughing on the side. I said, should I tell you what Safta means? And she understood what Safta meant. So over here, he does not use the word for old. Ki ben zekunim, a child of his old age. Rather, bar hakim. He was, instead of ben zekunim, a son of, no, he was a son who was wise. Because there are times in the Torah that the word wise is described as somebody who's old and has developed wisdom. As it continues, Vayom Yisrael el Yosef halo achecha. So again, it's Yisrael here and not Yaakov. And if you go back and read the parsha, you'll actually see that Yaakov and Yisrael go back and forth. So it's very interesting these times where it does say Yisrael. Is there something larger, something national, which is taking place over here? And again, this bringing Yosef to go see his brothers is what's going to bring him down to Egypt, and that's going to really be the beginning of the slavery. So is there something much bigger taking place? And Rashi does hint at that. But no, I want to note a word. V'yom Yisrael el Yosef halo achecha. So note brother. And it's not the first time that brothers were used. Brothers are used, and that's the word that we're looking for throughout today. The word brothers. He goes, halo achecha, ro'im bishchem. I want you to go see how your brothers are doing. And Yosef says, here I am. Now, if there is any kind of naivete, it's probably equaled on the one hand between Yaakov feeling that, you know, he can choose Yosef and everyone will understand. And it's Yosef who thinks that everybody understands what his position is. But Yomer lo, lechna ra'e et shlom achecha. See how your brothers are doing. And come back and tell me. Which, of course, is one of the things that the brothers were upset that Yosef goes back and talks too much and perhaps tells on them. And again, the Midrashim speak of this. And that's where Rashi notes from the depths of Chevron all the way back from the Brit Bein Abtarim for this covenant that was made between God and Avraham. That means that all that's coming to fruition. Excellent. So this is really, you know, quite strange that it tells us, you know, who he asks, you know, instructions to. That should not be all that notable. Unless this is the first time and maybe the last time in history that a man has asked for instructions and directions. So maybe that's why it's notable. But other than that, it seems to be just so coincidental or incidental. And what significant is it that he asks this person? Now remember that Yaakov had a meeting with an Ish, a mysterious Ish in the field. And there's many echoes between the life of Yaakov and the life of Yosef. And here is one of them, is that he meets this man in the field. He says, "What do you want?" Right? Almost sounds like, "Go make a wish." Matibakesh. Vayomer, and he says something which is so poignant and so powerful and so depressing, and that is, Yosef says, "Etachai enochi mivakesh, I want my brothers." And the problem is that they never reciprocated. They never wanted him. They were never looking for him. They never desired him. And Yosef does, again, that's the naivete. He wants his brothers. Hagidin ha'efohem, ro'im, where are they shepherding? And the man tells him where to go. Now we know that these places, Shechem and Dotan, which are in the general vicinity today of Shechem and Jenin, these are not nice places, and they're still in our headlines today, and they're still in the news today, and there's still bad things taking place over there. And then we get to this terrible, almost incomprehensible, but Yeru'ul Tomi Rachok, they see him from afar. Now that's actually very important, because they never see Yosef up front. I hope you understand what I mean. They see him from afar. That means they really don't understand Yosef. They only understand the general, the most really painting a picture with the broadest possible strokes, and not understanding really what Yosef was about, not understanding Yosef up front, not understanding Yosef in terms of what he really was interested in. And what he was interested in was them, was brotherhood, was this kinship, was this friendship, was this unity, but they only see him from afar. Uveterem yikarav aleihem v'nekiloto lamito. And even before he comes closer geographically, they discuss the plans to murder him. V'yeshvu lecho lechem, and we skipped a little bit, they strip him, throw him in the thing, and they sit down to eat bread. Now, I've noted before, and I just want to strengthen this, that's why we're here now. I've noted in the past that before they go down to Egypt, because that's really where all this leads, Yosef's about to be sent down to Egypt. Before they go down to Egypt, Yosef, the brothers sit down and they eat bread. So I felt, again, more of an intuition, that therefore before we leave Egypt, we need to sit down as a family and have a Pesach Seder, and then we can leave. And that we do before we leave Egypt, and that we do to commemorate it all the time. So and we invite brothers, and we invite family, even family who we don't want. We invite them over there. And as I said, it always struck me. So I just want to note for a moment, if you look at the Targum over here, V'yisrael rechem yat Yosef mikol baneyu. Okay, that was part we read, sorry. Pasuk Kaf Hei, Stone Source 2. V'ascharu lemecha lachma. Now, the question is, what does this word v'ascharu mean? It's a translation of v'yeshvu. They said, to eat bread, lemecha lachma, to eat lechem. So the word v'ascharu is the problem. What exactly does it mean? Because some of us, our Aramaic is not all that good. So if you look at source number 3, back where Yaakov is deceiving his father, which again, you're going to have to then wonder, you know, part of these echoes between Yaakov and Yosef. Yosef is going to end up, the brothers will deceive Yaakov, just as Yaakov has deceived his father. Yomer Yaakov alaviv, anochi Esav b'cherecha, asita kasher dibarti alav, kum na shva. Now, the word shva should be to sit. That's vayeshvu lecho lechem. Come, kum na shva, v'achla. And come, sit up, sit, and eat. But over here, Unculus writes, kum ka'an istachar. Now, istachar is the same Aramaic word as v'ischaru. So, now, just in case we still don't know what it means, we go to Rashi in source number 5, where he's dealing with the verse Kum Nashva, where Yaakov says to Yitzchak, sit up. So he writes Lashon Mesav al Hashulchan. It means to recline by the table. Lekach mitagam istachar. So therefore, the way that people used to eat in the olden days is they would lie back. So now it's really interesting. So I told you, I intuited that this is kind of a source for the Pesach Seder, the brothers sitting around and eating. So it's even better than eating later. They weren't sitting up; they were all reclining, and and eating their bread. So how interesting it is that on the Seder we're all commanded to recline. But I'm just saying that's actually here in the text, at least according to Unkelos, and that's how he renders the word Vayeshvu. So we'll continue, and then we have, and you could decide how you want to read this, then we have an act of brotherhood. Vayomer Yehuda el Echav. Why is it an act of brotherhood? Because Yehuda is speaking to his brothers. Ma betza ki narogat achinu. What are we going to gain from killing our brothers? Now, you could decide also, was he being sincere now, or is he being cynical? V'chisinu atamo, and cover up his blood. It's such a messy enterprise, is murder. It's really, you know, something which is unadvisable, or inadvisable. L'chu, instead, let's go v'nim karenu li'yishmaelim. Let's sell him to the Yishmaelim, v'yadein al tiyubo, and let our hands not be guilty of killing him. Why? Ki achinu b'sarenuhu. Because he is our flesh and blood. V'yishmu echav. If you want, we can bold that as well. And his brothers listen to him. So now, what we have over here is something and the opposite. We have brotherhood, seeking brotherhood, searching for brothers, not recognizing brothers, but recognizing brothers, wanting to kill a brother, not wanting to kill a brother. Let's not kill him because he's his brother. He's our brother. And let's sell him as well instead because he's our brother. So now, is Yehuda being cynical or is Yehuda being sincere? And I don't really have a good answer to that. All I can say is that there is, you know, I think the last time brothers behaved this badly, we had like our Cain and Hevel scene. And by the way, there is something to that as well, as much as Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, but he didn't say Cain and Hevel when he pointed it out. I'm saying that the brothers are shepherds, and that's like Hevel. Cain, on the other hand, is a farmer, and Yosef's dreams were about farming. The way Rav Soloveitchik took it is that he saw the future with the day that the land will be theirs. To be a farmer, you need to own land. If you're just a shepherd, then you could be like the Bedouin. You could be nomadic and go from place to place. And the brothers are going from place to place. They go from Shechem, they go from Hebron, they go to Shechem, they go to Dotan, and they go wherever they can graze. On the other hand, the farmer plants in one particular place. So therefore, Yosef is dreaming about the day the land will be ours, while the brothers are living this nomadic existence. On the other hand, they can look, and this is what I'm adding, they can look at Yosef and say, wow, look at this. His dreams are to be like Cain, and he's going to try to murder us. And again, you can see Cain as being more capitalistic. You can see him as being more possessive, and therefore a little bit, you know, a different kind of an attitude, and, you know, going back as far as, you know, the cowboys and the, what is it, the cowboys and whatever they say in Oklahoma can be friends. And over here, that seems to be a subtext. And I'll say it again. You have brotherhood and then the very opposite of brotherhood taking place. Yes, someone had to correct me. Brianna had to correct me here. Farmers. The farmers and the cowboys can be friends. The question is if that's true. Farmers and the ranchers. Okay, now we're getting to Machlokas Achronim. And someone's going to have to go and check it out, but I'm going to proceed onward. And again, you know what's bothering me. What's bothering me is the expressions of brotherhood and the expressions of brotherhood, which are, you know, you have Yosef, I'm looking for my brothers, and they only see him from afar. And then you have the brothers who are saying, you know, let's kill him. And then finally, no, how can we kill him? It's very messy, and he's our brother. Let's only sell him. And as I said, all of that is really quite disturbing, but what is the texture, the nature, the depth of this kind of brotherhood? And you see that there's something which is incredibly disturbing, what is being described over here. And I guess that pretty much takes us to the end of that chapter. And then we can continue. Yehuda goes on and gets married. The whole time frame over here is very interesting because Yehuda gets married. I mean, Yosef, we ended chapter 37 with Yosef being taken down to Egypt. Meanwhile, more or less during the same time, which could have been before, it could have been after, and around the same time, v'yered Yehuda meit echav. And again, Yehuda, I mean, some, including Rashi, he gets diminished by his brothers. I mean, look how upset their father is, and something has happened, but Yehuda moves on. V'yed ad ish adulami u'shmo chira, v'yarsham Yehuda bat ish kna'ani u'shmo shua, v'yikacheha v'yavo elah. So Yehuda now gets married. Now, who does he marry? He marries, well, what's her name? Well, it doesn't tell her her name. It tells her father's name and tells her father's national identity. He is a Canaanite. Now, if you've been following the story, marrying Canaanites has not been recommended till this point. It's been something we've been trying to avoid. So Yehuda goes, and, you know, this is the descent of Yehuda, Vayered Yehuda. You see that? Vayered. We can bold that as well. Vayered Yehuda. So the descent of Yehuda includes within it marrying somebody who is really inappropriate as far as everything we've learned ever since Yitzchak has been the age of dating, which, of course, he did by surrogate. So that we were told, Avram said, no, Yitzchak can't marry somebody who's local and go far away to find someone who's appropriate. Of course, you can ask the more practical question. You know, Yaakov's got a whole bunch of kids. Who are they supposed to marry? Okay, there's a problem. Maybe somebody should have opened up a Beis Yaakov over there. Okay, we'll leave that and continue. So he marries a Canaanite, and they have a son, Vatarid Hilad Ben Vikrat Shmo Er. Vatelet Od Vatelet Ben Vitikre Shmo Onan. Now, the name Onan, which actually has a connotation of mourning, is a little disturbing. V'tosef od v'telet ben v'tekret shmo shelo. V'yabi chziv b'leretoto. And they were in chziv at that time. V'yikach Yehuda isha la'er b'choro, u'shma tamar. And Yehuda takes a wife for his son. Now, that's actually very interesting. As much as Yaakov didn't take a wife for Yehuda, but Yehuda takes a wife for his. But the other thing which is interesting, by Yehuda, we did not know the name of the wife, but we knew the genealogy. We knew that she was from a Canaanite family. Over here, we know the name. Her name is Tamar, but we don't. We're not told who she is or where she's from. Again, the gut feeling, the reaction would be that she must be local, because otherwise we would know. But just again, I'm pointing out, notice the inverse over here, that by Yehuda, you know the name of, you know that it is the daughter of a Canaanite man, but you don't know the name. Over here you know the name, but you don't know who the family is. V'yi er b'cho Yehuda ra b'inei Hashem. And he does something which is wrong in the eyes of God, which we're not told what it is. The Midrashim will speak about it. And God kills him. V'yimiteyu Hashem. V'yom Yehuda la'onin, Bo el eshet achicha, v'yabem ota, v'hakem zera la'achicha. Now, this is absolutely, completely perplexing why Yehuda would say such a thing, or what in the world he's talking about. Now, some of you who are clever will say, yeah, there's laws of vayibum later on in the Torah. And then our response would be, and how exactly does Yehuda know the laws which are later on in the Torah? And you're going to come back and say, well, what are you talking about? His father, grandfather, and great-grandfather all kept the entire Torah. He knew all about this, and he knew about Hanukkah, and he knew about Purim, and he actually had a little too much to drink on Purim the year before, and so on and so forth. And you know that I'm going to say, okay, if that's what you want, well, his father actually married two sisters. I mean, that's also a little problematic in the Torah. And we can actually make this list of problematic things a little bit longer. And I'm going to say it again, it's completely perplexing. So and there's a number of possibilities. One is it's local custom. This is what they do. Two, it's Yehuda does know the future. Okay? Three, the future gets created because of what Yehuda says over here, and it's Yehuda's instinct himself. You could take any one of these approaches that you want, but I can't prove any of them, but I'll say the third one is, to me, the most intriguing, that Yehuda has a sense of brotherhood, and he tells his son, you need a sense of brotherhood. Now, you will realize why that itself would be ironic, and it goes back to what I said before the last chapter. When Yehuda is talking about Yosef, let's not kill him. He's our flesh and blood. Let's sell him. So it's a very interesting sense of responsibility. And maybe those of us who think he's being cynical is because we're cynical. We're used to being cynical. We grew up being cynical, right? You grew up watching television to learn how to be more cynical, right? That's what late-night television is. It just teaches you to be cynical. It teaches you to look at things and to find a twisted type of humor in all kinds of things. And over here, was Yehuda really being ironic, or is he being sincere? No, we don't kill our brothers when we get into a fight. We're going to sell them. We're going to get rid of them. And why? Because it's a sense of brotherhood. Over here, you have a further sense of brotherhood And I'm going to say, moreover, you have a sense of brotherhood being expressed by Yehuda, saying that this is your brother's wife, and I want you to continue the family, and I want you to take responsibility for her, and I want you to take responsibility for your dead brother. And that would be so interesting if this was created by Yehuda. By the way, there is a Medrash that supports this, just in case those of you who think I'm making it up. Now, I just want to pause for a second. Why would Yehuda expect his own sons to live to a level of brotherhood that seems to have escaped Yehuda himself? I'm not going to say right now that Yehuda's family all knew about the sale of Yosef. Although, on the other hand, when you have a secret which is known by 10 people, then very often that becomes more popular and more people know it and more people know it. But nonetheless, and incidentally, it sounds very much that either Tamar later on knows it or she has Ruach HaKodesh, but we're not going to get into that today. But maybe they see the way that Yehuda gets along with his family. Maybe they see the way that Yehuda gets along with his brothers. Maybe they don't sense that Yehuda ever had a great sense of responsibility for the brothers. And what was articulated by Yehuda, you know, let's get rid of her, don't kill him because of brotherhood, but it's a very twisted sense of brotherhood. And therefore, over here, his expectations that there will be brotherhood with his children, maybe that's a wrong expectation when you haven't displayed it yourself. In Pasuk Tet, Vayeda Onan ki lo ye Azera. It's not going to be his. Now, of course it's not, or it will, but that's not the point. The point is, how does Yehuda phrase it? Valesh l'chicha v'yebeimotah v'hekim zera l'chicha. Keep your brother alive. And he's not interested in doing that. He's not interested in that type of fidelity or that type of responsibility or that type of brotherhood. He is... It doesn't interest him. And it says, and he absolutely refuses to be intimate with her, at least in a way that she can become pregnant. And then God was very upset with what he did. Now there are those, again, based on the Midrash, who will say that God was upset with him, right? It's the same language. He did Rabbi Ne'ashem, Pasuk Zayin, and he does Rabbi Ne'ashem. And here it says God kills him as well. So those who claim that you can go backwards and say that what was it that Er had done? He did the same thing. And then the narrative, which is built by the Midrash, and maybe we'll have time to see it, is that she was beautiful and he didn't want to ruin her figure. He didn't want to ruin her beauty. He didn't want her to get pregnant. He thought that women are here for other reasons. Women are here for their beauty, and therefore both of them did the same thing, and therefore they both made sure that she would have become pregnant. But and it was coming from different places, both selfish, by the way. And Yehuda at this point is frustrated because, again, his desire for his sons, the brothers, to take responsibility for one another, it just doesn't happen. And then Tamar takes the actions in her own hands, and it says that in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Yehuda by this point has lost his wife as well, and he's experiencing some loneliness. Vayaged leTamar leMor, Hinecha Micha Ola Timnata leGoz Tzono. He's coming for shearing season. Vatasar Bigdei Amunata. She took off her clothing of mourning, and at this point Yehuda, what he had set up with her, saying, well, wait for my third son to get older, even though he had absolutely no intention to have him marry her, to take responsibility. And she's just waiting. She's waiting and waiting, and, you know, as they would say, the biological clock is ticking, and he's just telling her to wait. So it says that she changes her clothing, and she waits along the way. And it says again clearly, Kirataki Gadal Shelo Vilonat Loli Isha, and she's just told to wait. But Yehuda sees her, that's Pasuk Tetvav, and he thinks that she's a prostitute. Kikistapana, for her face was covered. Vayetele Aladerech, and he stops and he propositions her along the way. Vayomer, and he says to her, Havo na avoy elayich, can I have relations with you, please? He didn't say please, I just didn't want him. No, maybe yes. Havana, he says, please. Can I have relations with you, please? Ki lo yadaki kalatohi, because he did not know of the relationship that this was his daughter-in-law, but tomer matitainli kitavo elai. She says, what are you going to give me? And so they're negotiating over here. And he says, I don't have any cash on me. I'll send you over the goat and so on and so forth and give me the collateral. And along the way, they're intimate and she gets pregnant. And then he said Yehuda sends someone to start looking to pay his debts, because Yehuda likes to pay his prostitute debts. And he goes looking for her and he can't find her. V'lo matza. By the way, it is interesting because he thought she was a zonah, and the guy looking thinks she's a kitesha. Kitesha may actually be a more of a temple prostitute and have a different connotation to it. And they say, there was no temple prostitute around here. I didn't find her. There wasn't anyone like that. He goes, okay, it's enough. We don't have to become humiliated. Like you to say, I'm not going to put an ad in the paper saying, will the prostitute who was intimate with Yehuda, please make herself known? And he says, forget it. I tried. I did my best. Couldn't find her. Let's move on. He then discovers that she is pregnant. That he's told that she had committed znut, which is an inappropriate sexual relationship, kalatecha, your daughter-in-law, v'gamine haralizunim, and now she's carrying this illegitimate child. V'yom Yehuda otziua v'tisaref. And Yehuda says, have her taken out to be burnt. Now, this point that Yehuda says, take her out to be burnt, is quite perplexing on all kinds of levels. If you're going to insist to me, and there are those who are going to try so hard to walk up this line, and they're going to say, no, Yehuda was keeping halach, he was even keeping yibum. So if Yehuda was keeping yibum, so then why is he saying take this woman out to be burnt? Just hold on a second, because you're going to find a very elegant answer. And as she's being taken out, she sends to her father-in-law and the collateral that she's taken and says, this is the guy who made me pregnant. And then he realizes that it's him. And Yehuda was guilty. And it says, Vayakar Yehuda, Vayomot Sadkami Meni, she's more righteous than I am. Because I refused to give my other son to her. And then he never knew her again. Now, Let's go back a little bit. This idea of Yehuda approaching a zonah, if you want, we can open up the Rambam in the beginning of Ilchot Yishut, who essentially says that before the Torah was given, then sexual relations were subject to negotiations and agreement and money being passing hands, and it's absolutely fine. So therefore, I can then say, if Yehuda keeps the Torah, then he has a problem. But before Matan Torah, there was no such thing as Kedushin. Now, that's so says the Rambam. Okay. On the other hand, did they have a law of Bnei Noach? Bnei Noach does have a sense of marriage, and we'll leave this because again, I don't want to get overly halachic right now. But I will note that when Shimon and Levi were upset with the city of Shechem, and again, we're back to Shechem as being our problematic place, their moral argument they made with their father, who says, how can you do such a thing? Do you want to turn her into a zonah? So therefore, being a zonah is not something which is so nice, by the way, if it's your sister. Again, notice the brotherhood and the feelings of brotherhood and taking care of your sister, but the fact that Yehuda can treat someone like a zonah, so that should be a little disturbing, but nonetheless, we're going to move on, and there's something really specific I want to say. In source number 8, which is the Medrash Rabbah, Hotzi'ua v'tesaref, take her out to be burnt. Ephraim mikasha'a, Talmido Shrubi Meir, Omar Mishrum Meir. Now, he's mentioned half a dozen times in rabbinic literature. He's a student of Meir, says Rav Meir's name. Tamar, we were told her name, Bito Shel Shem Haita. She was the daughter of Shem. Tichtiv Uvat Ish Kohen. Leficha Chetziu V'Tisaref. She's a Bat Kohen, and the Bat Kohen speaks about the sins of the daughter of a Kohen, and there it does mention Srefa. So over here, I hope you realize the brilliance of this. I mean, there's all kinds of difficulties, but the brilliance is trying to justify Yehuda's behavior. Yehuda was right. Yehuda's right, take her out to be burnt because she's a Bat Kohen. Who is her father? Her father is Shem. Now, how you know Shem is a Kohen is itself a problem. That her father is Shem presents a whole other problem. And we'll continue. In source number 10, where it doesn't speak about her coming from shame, it talks about Tamar, and it says she's like the Ktoret. It's saying, no, she's really this wonderful person. Right? Shetimer Masek Ktoret. Ktoret brings about forgiveness. Source number 10, similar thing. Source number 11, we're told, oh, again, that Tamar, who was Amr Tam Bat Shem Ben Noach, Haytav Haytah Na'e Biyoter. She won't be as beautiful if she has children. The Torah is telling, the Midrash is telling that we're using some metaphors over here, and we don't want to explain exactly what was done, but what was supposed to be done wasn't done. Let's put it like that. And therefore, he made sure that she would not become pregnant. The Targum Yonatan says, who is this Tamar? It says, Barat Shem Rabba, the daughter of shame. So now you see that approach that Rabbi Meir taught is there as well. Bat Shem Gadol, the Alshich as well. And he mentions that who's her father? The Alshich says, must be Malki Tzedek. Because Malki Tzedek is described as a Kohen Le'el Elyon. So if she's going to become a Bat Kohen, so Malki Tzedek. But by the way, that only got you halfway out of it, because Malki Tzedek is described as being shame. So therefore, it's shame, it's Malki Tzedek. You do remember where he shows up. It's only back in chapter 14 in Bereishit, Perek Yudalid, with the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings. At the end, Malki Tzedek then shows, Melech Shalem, Kohen Le'el Elyon. So Malki Tzedek lived a long time ago. His daughter may not be all that young, but nonetheless, going back to this point that she's called Tamar, he tells us that the name itself, at the very end, he says the name itself points towards righteousness, as he notes from Tehillim, Tzadik ka Tamar yifrach ke erez lo nyuskeh. You can maybe, if you want to work harder, Shetulim b'Beit Hashem, you can maybe talk about B'chatzrot Elokein Yafrichu, you can maybe talk about being the Kohen Elyon, being the Kohen in Yerushalayim, Melech Shalem, and you can work hard and work all that out. Rashi cites this to explain Batis Saref, and says, because she's the daughter of Shem, and about Kohen. The Siftei Chachamim does a little bit of the math for you. Lav Davka Bito, maybe it's not his daughter, maybe granddaughter, great-granddaughter, great-great-granddaughter. To Hashem Kvar Meit Kesha Yaakov Chamishim. Shem died when Yaakov was 50. Vatayo Termi Ben Meav Esrim. And if you do the math, Yaakov is now, that means he's been dead for 60 years. So how old can his daughter be if Shem has been dead for 60 years? So it says Elami Mishpachto. It can't really mean what it says. The Rambam's son, Rav Avraham, in source number 20, well, I just want to go back to 19 for a second. The Psikta says over here, Zantak Tamar Kalatecha, that your daughter-in-law, Tamar, is guilty of znot, Vaznot Ayakashalahim. Meaning, why does he treat this with such severity? Take her out and burn her, because znot is very bad. And I want to point something out, which some of you will understand already, that if Tamar is guilty of znot, and znot is really bad, and nonetheless, Yehuda went and visited a zonah, so what do you call that? Other than inconsistency, or perhaps worse. I know some of you are going to tell me all kinds of technical reasons. In source number 20, Rav Avraham Ben Aram writes, says, take her out to be burnt. Marakia min hagaya etzlam laharog et hanisua im zinta. Vezkuka li yibum haita etzlam bemadrigat eshetish umitzvat Yehuda alze vikim mitzvato. Now, v'rayaki hoya shofet anashav inovim ilav. So what it just now did is it said Yehuda was known as a judge, and his decisions were final. And then he kind of slips in something here, which none of you noted what he did. I'll explain. And he says, and the law for such a person in those days in that place, now he had to qualify, I'll explain why in a moment, was that if somebody was guilty of this kind of aznut, then you take them out to be killed. Now, can we be technical on a couple of things? One, if you really want to say that Yehuda's keeping halacha over here and everything is being done, and therefore she's about Kohen and so on and so forth, which, by the way, that's not what the Rambam said, I will then note that if he's being a judge, then normally if you're being a judge in a case of someone you're related to, you need to recuse yourself, because you can't be a judge in such a situation, right? If you're related to the defendant, then you cannot be a judge in such a case. Nonetheless, you're going to find all kinds of people working extremely hard to try to make all of this work out in terms of halacha. The Datz Kanim for Balei Tosfot, oh, take her out to be killed, and he quotes this teaching from Rav Meir, saying that she was about Kohen, and you know, it's Vitema. Shaloha yu edim v'atra'a. He goes, there were no witnesses. She wasn't warned. How could you tell me that this is, that she's a bat kohen, so we're following the Torah, we're following the halacha. You're not following halacha. Now, I said the problem is with the judge. Forget the problem with the judge. You have a problem. There's no witnesses. There's no hatra'a. None of this works in Jewish law. V'tiritz Rav Yosef Me'eretz Yisrael. Now, this is one of the Balei HaTosfot. I looked him up, and he's called, and you see in yellow, Rav Yosef Mikaltson Ish Yerushalayim. Mea Olim Le'eretz Yisrael Ba'aliyat Balei HaTosfot Talmid Ria Zaken. So he was one of the Balei HaTosfot. So he explains, V'tiritz Rav Yosef Me'eretz Yisrael Didor Poritz Haya. Sometimes people are, a generation could be on a low moral stature, so therefore we need to be stricter than normal. And therefore that's what Yehuda goes, therefore that's what they did over here. And then he points out afterwards, but the math is really difficult. He's being technical. Forget about the math. He goes, how can he go back to the Beit Avicha? He's dead already. By the way, he's not bothered by the problem that she may be 100 years old. He's bothered by the problem. How can he say, go back to your father's house? He says, okay, you can still call the father's house even if the father's not there anymore. So, as I said, we worked hard. He was called here Rav Yosef Me'eretz Yisrael in the Hadar Zakenim. He's going to call him Rav Yosef Ish Yerushalayim, and we're going to have a similar kind of discussion. In source number 23, the Moshe Zakenim, also from the Balei HaTosfos, he mentions this tradition, and he does not love, and he does some of the math, and he finds that she, forget, 100 years old, that would be a spring chicken. Lefizem kein haita tamar bat mea shmonim v'shesh lefachot. So he says, a little hard to say that that's who she was. And again, he does all the math. And by the way, then he goes to the math. He goes with Aaron Onan. He goes, he was probably, according to my math, 7 years old. So he's seven. She's 186. You wonder why the relationship didn't work out. Okay, this was incompatible in a way that you can't imagine. But as I said, we're working too hard over here, and he goes through some of this math and some of this discussion. But he also brings a midrash, v'nimtza b'psikta. Okay, you see it over here, d'Rav Kahana, and he says, "Rabot banot asuchayil ba adam arishon v'nitztava al avodah zarah." Adam was the one who's commanded at Avodah Zarah. Noach amitzot Ev Menachai, Avram al Hamila, v'Yitzchak lechancho chet yamim. Yitzchak was the first one to have a brit in 8 days. V'Yaakov al Gidanasha, Yehuda al Hayibum, and Yehuda was the one. Now it's not clear if Yehuda was commanded it or Yehuda was the one who started it. V'Hayibum nitztavu la'acho la'acher min hakrovim. T'chtiv tzad kamimeni. He goes, Amram Kasha, Daduch Tevotziu. You know, how can you say, take her out to be killed? And here he points out, because he actually learned the Gemara in Yevamot, which I won't accuse any of you of. Yes, I'm picking on all of you. Where it says that Shomeret Yibum, Shezinta, Chad Amar Ba'asei, V'chad Amar Bilav, Avomita Kulial Mulo. So I need to explain this a little bit. What is a Shomeret Yibum? A Shomeret Yibum is a woman who, chas v'shalom, her husband passed away. And they didn't have any children. So now she has to have either Yibum or Chalitza. So now there is something called Zika, which connects her to the brothers of the deceased. So over here, what we're told is that she's not really married. And what Zika is this great halakhic conundrum. But this is the important part. The woman who is a Shomeret Yibum, waiting for the Yibum to take place, one opinion of the Gemara is that it's a mitzvah taseh, that to have Yibum is a mitzvah taseh. And one says that it's a lav, that she's not allowed to marry. But Mita, no one says that she's guilty of a death penalty for this. So how can you, if you're going to say that she's Shomeret Yibum, then how in the world can you say she should be taken out to be killed for this? This doesn't really seem to work that well. And we know one of the approaches over here is that Yehuda was being machmir. Look at source 24. Yehuda hichmir ala. He was being machmir. It's always good to be machmir in somebody else. So again, I want to pause for a moment because maybe we just now got very lost along the way. And we're going to make a little bit of a twist and turn, and then I want to make sure that you see what we did. But Yehuda, if he really does introduce Yibum, and that's what it sounds like, then it sounds like Yehuda has this wonderful sense of brotherhood. On the other hand, Yehuda doesn't seem to have a wonderful sense of brotherhood. On the third hand, maybe Yehuda was not being cynical, and there really was this strange sense of brother, don't kill Yosef, let's sell him because he's our brother. But what Yehuda's children get out of Yehuda's parenting is really what's interesting, because they don't seem to have the same sense of Yibum. And again, it would be fascinating to follow that psikta and say, yes, Yehuda, out of a sense of brotherhood, creates the law of Yibum. And then the Torah later on tells us of this law that Yehuda created. I don't have to say it was local law. I don't take it was local custom. Yehuda sees this as being something which is a moral responsibility of brothers and the sense of brotherhood, which again is really interesting and really ironic given Yehuda's track record. So I'm going to say it again. We don't really know exactly what we should be doing with all of this, but nonetheless, I want to continue. There are those who are so troubled by all of this that they go and they create a whole different difficulty, which means maybe Yehuda never said to take her out and burn her. I know it says it, but maybe he never said it. So you already, I hope, appreciate the path I'm going down. Just totally say it doesn't say what it says, but give me a second, because it really is quite interesting. So if you look at the Baal HaTurim, again, this also in a sense comes out of that Tosfot school, but he tells us of Yehuda HaChassid Pirish Lo Dana. There was one opinion that says that it can't be to burn her, and what it really must be is that they were going to kill her by skila, by stoning, and then burn the body. So I don't know if that made anyone feel better. But still, let's go back now to the Baal HaTurim. Rav Yehuda Chassid Pirish, Lo Dan Oto Yehuda L'Sreifa, Ela She'yisrefu La Roshem Bein Ponea L'Simon Shehi Zona. To put a mark on her, I'm sure this is known in literature, to put a mark on her face in order everyone can see, to brand her as a prostitute. That's what Yehuda HaChassid suggests. Ketav HaKabbalah, he cites this as well, and he says that the Rush also said it. By the way, that the Rush said it is now more interesting, because the Rush is the father of the Torah, right? Because our Rush Kamosha who od ad hayom b'vnei Yishmael shekol zona shemefakeret atzma sorfim bechotim shel barzel al mitzcha liot zikukim liyibum. So he's saying that the Muslims that he is aware of were still doing it in the day of the Rush. Actually, the Rush, when he comes to Spain, he was from Germany, when he comes to Spain, he finds that Jews are following this Muslim practice, and he's absolutely shocked about it. There's a tshuva of the Rush about this. By the way, there may be this idea of putting a sign may be connected also to the oath of Cain, right? Cain is also something going on where he's afraid whoever finds him is going to kill him, and God says, I'll put for you a sign. So what does that sign mean? So there are some who want to say the same kind of approach. Ibn Ezra says, okay, Kia ot Karen, v'cherim amru shenatan chozik bilibo, that God gave him strength. The Ramban quotes a Midrash saying, Rabbi Abba Rekelev Masarlo, that God gave him a dog. Gave him a dog to take care of him because he was afraid by himself. So, and we will, I think we had enough with that. Look at Rashi, by Kain, v'yisemlo Kain ot chakaklo ot mishmo b'mitzcho, that there was something put on his forehead. So now you realize that this idea that some of the Rishonim, Yehuda HaChassid and others, are saying about, oh, to burn her, they're saying, oh no, that's really what happened with Cain, somebody who has a stain of sin on them, and therefore, you know, we got to Cain before somehow. Surprisingly, we got back to Cain again. The Tzitz Eliezer in 32 is going to talk more about that Rush and talk about this whole approach, and I hope we've had enough about this. Yeah, it was the Shadal who says in Source 34, he quotes someone who claims that they'd burn her after stoning. And let's just pause with this for a moment. Do you realize what happened over here? Because something really interesting happened. Nobody's talking about how Yehuda is really guilty, except for one person. And who's that? Yehuda. Right? Tzadka Mimeni. Which, what's the implication? Tzadka Mimeni. That, you know, I haven't behaved all that well over here. And everybody over here is showing how, no, Yehuda's following halacha. He's creating halacha. He's doing everything right. What are you talking about? I mean, Yehuda over here should be completely wrong. And nonetheless, we have this we have this wonderful, complicated way that we're trying to defend him. On the other hand, maybe on the other hand, we find something interesting when it goes to one of Yehuda's brothers who did something, I'll say, that which we can at least compare. Okay, there's actually two of the brothers that we can compare, and we'll go, hopefully have time to look at both of them. But first, I want to look at one of the brothers that does something similar. And let's take a look what happens. Which brother am I talking about? Obviously, the next source, Reuven. So what did Reuven do? Reuven slept with Bilhah. Now that's not a nice thing to do. She is his father's, now by the way, wife, concubine. This is what to talk about. So the next line I neglected to put a number in. And because of this, he lost his right as firstborn. Onkelus says what he did. That the Targum says he slept with her. Targum Yonatan cleans it up. What does he do? And you should know this from Rashi. What does he do? He moved the beds around. He wasn't happy. The whole narrative over here, Rachel had died. Yaakov's bed was in Rachel's tent. Rachel died. So Yaakov then moves in with Bilhah, and he finds, hold it, that you loved my, that you loved Rachel more than my mother, Reuven says, I understand. But that now you're going to Bilhah? How can you do that to my mother? And therefore he drags the bed into Leah's tent. Now, it doesn't say any of that, except if you look in Rashi or if you look in other Midrashim, they say that. And that's what the Targum Yonatan does here as well, that Ubilbil Yat Mitzah Debilha. Rashi Mitoch Shubilbil Mishkoimela Alavakatuv Ki'ilu Shachva. Because he got involved in his father's sleeping arrangement, it's as if he slept with her. Now, you do realize that's a little bit of a stretch. Now, the Mishnah, in source number 40, which is talking about Kriyat HaTorah. So one thing you need to know, in the olden days, when they read the Torah, they also read the Targum. Why? Because they want people to understand it. It would really be like in shuls today, if they would read it in Hebrew, then read it in English. So it's interesting they read the Targum. And you know, if any shul did that, then they would accuse them of being reform or worse. Maaseh Reuven, when it comes to the section of Reuven, Nikra Velomit Targum. You read the words, but you don't read the Targum. You don't want the kids understanding what went on over there. You want to keep it quiet. And what does the Targum say? Targum says that he slept with her. Targum says what the Chumash says. Masei Tamar, Nikro Mitargem. When it comes to the Tamar episode, then you do tell. And the rest of the mission is interesting as well. There is going to be all kinds of intrigue. What Masei Tamar? Masei Reuven, Tosa Yantur says, Vayishkavet Bilopi Legeshaviv. Right? Nikro Bebeda Knesset. You read it in Shul, Volomitargem, but you don't say over the Targum. Dichayshinan Lignutau. We're worried that people are going to look down at him. Kipirish Rashi. Well, of course people should look down at him, because he did, that's what he did. V'haran pirish mishum kibud aviv, kavod aviv, kavod Yaakov. No, it's because it's an embarrassment for Yaakov, so it's not because we want to cover up Reuven's action, we don't want to humiliate Yaakov. But either way, it's not to be read, not to be explained. Maaseh Tamar, katzav harav, and he says, Bartunur says, that's Amnon v'tamar, v'kachos haramban. Now that's really interesting, because that's not what you would have thought. He goes along the way over here and says, Vaharan Maaseh Tamar v'Yehuda. No, but it's interesting. What did it say that there? It says there you read the text and you read the Targum. So it says when it comes to the, no, there's no cover-up. But it's interesting that that's the case. We've time in Maharshik Mara, 1 second. Tamar, Misham de'itani Yehuda, Avina, Uvdi de Yosef. It would have said the action of Yehuda, that Yehuda's got a whole bunch of things on his list. If it would have just said the action of Yehuda, you would have thought it was selling Yosef. So therefore, it says the action of the Maaseh Tamar, which just goes more to this point that, you know, Yehuda would seem to be problematic, and we're defending Yehuda left and right, which then leads me to our third case, which is similar. And what's that? That's, of course, Yosef. Now, Yosef is a tzaddik, and we can read this as many times as you want. And Yosef is approached by Mrs. Potiphar. Pasuk Zayin, Vayiachad Ruma Eile, Vatisa Eshet Adonav Etenel, Yosef, Vatomash Shechvayimi, sleep with me, Vayimain, and he refuses. Vayomar El Eshet Adonav, Hein Adoni Lo Yodai Tiba Min Abayit, Vakol Hashay Yesh Natan V'Yado. v'yadi, and so on and so forth. Any gadol b'bayit hazeh mimeni lo chasach mimeni mu'uma ki imotach v'asher at ishto. How can I do something so wrong? I would sin to God as well. Which means Yosef doesn't sin. Yosef, and then, day after day after day, and he refuses. And no one's home. So now there's two ways of reading this. And you're going to have to tell me which way you prefer. One is that Yosef comes to the house and thinks no one is there. Or Yosef comes to the house knowing that she's there. Now, I don't know which way to read this, but I do know Yosef based on his track record and based on what's going to happen. But Tifseo b'vigdo, and she grabs him, Loma shechvayimi. V'yazov b'gdo v'yada v'yanas v'yatzer chutzah. And Yosef runs away, which means everything is consistent over here, that Yosef is completely righteous, Yosef does nothing wrong, and nonetheless, Yosef gets treated in the opposite way that Yehuda gets treated, which is Yehuda does something which is objectively wrong, and we're going and working hard and trying to show, in terms of halacha, how Yehuda is justified, and then when it comes to Yosef, we're going to find all kinds of ways of attacking. By the way, the Targum that we read by Yosef actually says something interesting. But remember, it says he came to the house, no one was there. Lasot melachto, right? Lasot melachto, to do his work. We'll see that there are some who explain that melachto is a euphemism and that Yosef wanted to be with her. So look what the Targum does over here. And Yosef comes, right, source 43, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vavak Yom Adin Va'al Lebeita Lemivdak Bekitvei Chushbana. He goes to check the records. He did not go to be with her. He went to do his work. What was his work? He was the accountant. Meaning, what would a Jewish boy be doing in the house of Potiphar? He's the accountant. And again, that's what it says. I'm not even making this up. Still, what, you want him to be the dentist? No. He's the accountant. He goes in to do his job. And then nobody else is there, and then she attacks him. Yosef is a victim. I mean, do we all get this? That Yosef is a victim. And over here, not only blaming the victim, we're going to start judging him. Look at Rashi. Yom Eid Shalahem, Shalhul, right? We got a vote of Zara, we got a vote of us. Umra, Ainli, right? There's no other time that I'm going to get to Yosef. Lasot Melachto, Rav Vishmuel. Chadamar Melachto Mamash. One says he had work to do. Vachadamar Lasot Tzrachav Ima, in order to fill his needs. Elishinereit lo Dmut Diukno Shel Aviv. But what happened, he saw the image of his father, as the Gemara says in Sota. By the way, I saw something interesting about this, that over here in the Talmud Bavli, it says that he sees the image of his father, which my father, this I'm not sure he'll have to qualify if it's the psychologist in him or the rabbi in him, would say that this was the superego, it's his father's values that he sees right here, and therefore he wants to do it, but therefore he runs away. Which means he went in, lasot melachto. Meaning either way, Yosef walks out heroically, whether it be because he first wanted to sin or he walks out otherwise. Now, before we continue about all the people that are going to attack him, I told you that this is interesting that he sees his father. I just want to show you something, which you don't have. I did not share this with you because I found this after I sent it. Source 54 and 55, one is from the Talmud Yerushalmi, one is from the Bereshit Rabbah, and they both add in one little interesting suggestion. V'ra'i kano shel aviv, and he sees his father's image. Miyad, he'd say, and then he was able to control himself. Midei avir Yaakov, amar Rabbi Avin, af ikinon shel Rachel. He saw his mother's image as well. So it's not just his father, he saw his mother, which I want to explain in a second. In Source 55, it says the same thing. Rav Hunim, b'shem Ravatna, ikinon shel aviv, ra'av etzinan damo, and that cooled him down. That was better than a cold shower at that moment. By the way, some explain that there's two different, some explain that he sees his father, some say he's in a dream, some say chalom, some think maybe it's a chalon, or it could be that he sees his own image and he thinks that, and he sees his father. Suddenly he realizes how much he looks like his father, and his father would never do such a thing. But Rabbi Menachma b'shem Rabbi Imi, ikunin shel ima rav etzinon dama. What was it that cooled him down, his mother? Now, I'm sure that the Freudians, again, if the father was the superego who knows what they're going to do with this, that he sees his mother at that point, I just want to say it in a spiritual sense, okay, if that's okay with you. I know all of you have to get your minds out of the gutter, and I want to say it in a spiritual sense. His mother was the one, again, at least according to the Medrash, we know that his mother was supposed to marry his father, and then somehow his mother's not there, and Leah's there. According to the way the Medrash says it, is she says, I loved Yaakov, I wanted to be with Yaakov, but I controlled my passion. And because I knew that I did not want to embarrass my sister. And by the way, we're going back to the core of the sense of, I can't call this fraternity because it's two sisters of sorority. I don't know how to call it. It's the sense of brotherhood or sisterhood whereby Leah and Rachel care for one another. But what is it that Rachel did? She controlled her sexual passion. She wanted to be with this man and she controlled herself. How interesting, you know, this Yerushalmi or this Midrash Rabbah who say that he sees the image of his father and the image of his mother, and his mother had this ability of controlling her passion and therefore not doing what she wanted to do. But why in the world have I gone there? Which means all of this is wrong. Yosef didn't do anything wrong. So you have, you know, Reuven doing something wrong, let's cover it up. All that he did, he was an interior decorator and he thought the bed looked better in the other tent. Okay, and now we're done with Yosef. With Reuven. And you realize there's something wrong with that. And Yehuda, all we're doing is looking at Yehuda as a judge over here. Was she a Bat Kohen? Was she not a Bat Kohen? She's 186 years old, but she's a Bat Kohen and so on. And you say, what in the world, you know, how did we get there? And then it comes to Yosef, who doesn't want to be with her. He tells her, I don't want to be with you. It would be wrong for me to be with you. And then let's start blaming Yosef over here. And all of this, I'll say it again, is just so completely remarkable that I don't know what to do with it, because why are we giving some people the benefit of the doubt and the other people who deserve the benefit of the doubt based upon their track record? Again, Yehuda does not deserve the benefit of the doubt. Yosef does. We give it to Yehuda, we don't give it to Yosef, and that should be what bothered us. Unless, of course, there's something else which is going on. And then, again, that's what I wanted to get back to. That Yehuda, when he said, don't kill Yosef, there really was a sense of brotherhood. Again, for us, that was difficult because we're cynical. But maybe that was sincere, absolutely sincere. We don't kill. Yosef is dangerous. Yosef can't be here. Yosef is causing all kinds of problems. But what are you talking about killing him? He's our brother. And there was something sincere about that. And therefore, Yehuda is equally sincere when he talks to his kids. But his kids don't get that message. His kids don't understand the subtlety of Yehuda. And Yehuda really does create this law of Yibam. Because he thinks that there should be brotherhood. He thinks there should be responsibility. Now, why am I now giving him the benefit of the doubt? I mean, he's done a lot of things which are wrong. For a very simple reason, because I know how the story ends. The story ends is that Yehuda ends up standing up and taking responsibility for his brothers. Yehuda ends up with this sense of brotherhood, which emerges out of something. Now the question goes back, so where did that emerge from? So you want to tell me Yehuda's transformed? Fine. That's not my question. My question is, where did the sense of brotherhood come from? And even with Yehuda, if I want to pick on him, and I carefully read through the whole soliloquy, the whole speech that he gives in Parshat Vayigash, and by the way, it's touch and go there. We can do it if you want to, but I'm already over time, so I have to stop in a minute. It's touch and go there, because he speaks about his brother, and but he also speaks about his father. At the end of Yehuda's speech, it's not about his brother, but it's about his father that he needs to try to fix that relationship. It's the father. He can't see his father suffer anymore. But the whole sense of it is Yehuda becomes the leader. Yehuda and his brothers. And the brothers do look up for him. And Yehuda does take responsibility. And how strange it may be that you, because again, you all would have said, and I would have been the first one to say it, that the sale of Yosef represents within Yehuda a total moral failing. And I'm going to say that no, that what was on the table at the time was the murder of Yosef. And Yehuda has this, for us, extremely strange sense of brotherhood, where he says, no, brothers don't kill one another. And even if there needs to be some kind of a change over here, we're not going to kill him. What I'm really then suggesting is that somehow out of this, again, morally problematic, troubling sale of Yosef, and we know that on the one hand, Yosef ends up fulfilling this divine mission of the Jews having to go down to Egypt and the Brit Bein HaBetarim and the enslavery and so on, and all this will begin over here. So how interesting. Again, normally we would say that the greatness of Yehuda emerges with those words, Tzadka Mimeni, she's more righteous than I am. But it could be that there is something beforehand, which is really where it emerges from, that Yehuda was sincere. And therefore, Yehuda is trying to raise his kids to be sincere. And therefore, Yehuda creates this law of Yibum, because Yehuda is interested in brothers taking care of one another. And Yosef and Yehuda is interested in some type of redemption. And therefore, there needs to be, things need to be fixed, including within these brothers, and those are his sons. And Yehuda is trying to teach something over here. Now, we can argue about how he does it. We can argue all kinds of things. Is that when it comes down to it, Reuven never seems to be, you know, we can say as much as you want, Reuven, that's true, but there's no redemption over there. There's a failing. When it comes to Yehuda, there is redemption. And now, where did that redemption come from? Redemption may have began much earlier than we suspected, right there. No, don't kill him. He's our brother. And I'll say it again, that's completely, completely sincere. As far as Yosef goes, there are those who actually articulate, for one, I can show you inside, but I just don't want to, who say that the thing about Yosef was is that he did walk out. And then it comes to this old debate, what's better? Not have Yetzirah at all and walk out of the room, or to have Yetzirah and to walk out of the room? Which means it could be in certain people's minds that to say that Yosef is struggling with the Yetzer, that's what makes him a Yosef HaTzadik. It's the walking out of the room. Either way, he walks out. He runs out. Now the question is, but what did he want to do? Did he want to be there or did not want to be there? So that debate about what's greater, to want to sin and not sin or not want to sin and not sin, what is really greater, that becomes then the debate about who Yosef is, not because they're trying to attack Yosef, but quite the opposite. They're trying to put Yosef on the highest moral level. The only question is, what is the highest moral level? Is the highest moral level somebody who has absolutely no interest, no desire, or somebody who walks out because they have absolute interest and absolute desire, but nonetheless, it's morally wrong? Yosef gives that speech, this is morally wrong. It will be wrong against my boss, it will be wrong against your husband, it will be wrong against God, and he walks out. But we're not told about what he feels. What does he want? So he sees the image of his father and he runs out. And now we learn today something else. Maybe even he sees the image of his mother and he walks out. Maybe seeing the image of his mother is what gives him the strength to walk out, gives him the strength to delay gratification. No, this is not the right time. It's not the right place. It's not the right person. I'll wait. See, that's really interesting. Yosef is going to emerge being the tzaddik. Why? Because I'm teaching today. And you know that whenever I teach, Yosef is the tzaddik. That's the way it works. That's part of the rules over here. But what we did over here is that we gave Yehuda more credit than we, I think, normally would have. And maybe the core, that's what's so interesting, is that the core of greatness comes in the least expected places. The important thing is that what's around all of this story are brothers who don't get along. And now you realize why it's so essential for the story to end up with brothers getting along. Because we have to be unified, that we have to get along, that we have to get past the problems. And therefore, if Yehuda has a mob and saying, let's kill this brother who's not like us, and Yehuda say, no, we don't kill brothers. Maybe we don't get along. Maybe we won't live together. We're not going to invite him for Thanksgiving. But that doesn't mean, that does not mean that you kill a brother. You know, that you don't do. And therefore, maybe there is something much stronger in Yehuda, and it's not being cynical. It's something which is stronger than we perhaps realized. And as I said, that's the shift that took place between the 6th of October and the 7th of October, where there was a great deal of dysfunctionality within the Jewish community in Israel. And now there's this great deal of unity. And we hope and pray that God sees the unity, accepts the unity, and that he will protect all of us, and he will allow us to be completely victorious with no more injuries and no more, you know, soldiers falling, God forbid, and that God accepts this unity itself as something which is extremely holy, because ultimately we've come to this realization that we are one people, and we do not kill our brothers, and we do not push them aside. And maybe even now, you know, we move to whenever the day after the war is over, maybe we will have learned something exactly that we took out of those tanks that we were in together, or fighting side by side, or where we died side by side. And all of those situations that perhaps now we'll realize also take that next step and have learned something and have grown something, that even those times that we couldn't get along, now we realize that there are rules of engagement, there's rules of disagreeing, there are ways that we could disagree with one another with respect, but always with that profound knowledge and understanding that when it comes down to it, we're brothers.